welcome, everyone. I wish I could whistle like my two sisters. They can take the roof down, which I can't whistle at all. So I'm just going to talk loudly.
Do you have a lecture schedule?
I do. I just got it. Welcome to the first lecture of this term. It's great to see you all. And I want to just give you a little heads up about a couple of lectures that are coming now that we are in our summer term. Next week will be the Reverend Doug Calhoun speaking on the father wound and its impact on your spiritual journey. And then our own Mary Frances Giles on May 27th, Living with Longing in a Fallen World. Some more very interesting ones. The schedule is on the website, and it's also there are copies out in the front hall table. But I especially want to mention our sort of seminar, Friday night and Saturday seminar on June 17th and 18th on the gift of imagination, our call to live creatively. So put that on your calendars and try to come for a whole day. Tonight, we're talking about the Labrie story from Switzerland to Southborough. And I think I'll open in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, I do thank you for the existence of Labrie. I thank you for this wonderful story, which Mrs. Schaefer recorded so well in her book, Labrie, and which has continued since the closing of that book in many different places on this globe. Thank you for your faithfulness in starting and continuing this work, and we pray that you would continue to bless it and that all of us in all the branches would be faithful to your calling. Be with us this evening, in Jesus' name. Amen. Dick and I and the other Labrie members in our branch recently returned from the Swiss Labrie, where our annual members meetings were held this year. And just to give you a definition, a member, when I talk about a Labrie member, it's a term for those in leadership in the branches. Every year, the members get together and we elect 7 trustees to represent us. But all members are actually working in branches, so we're also workers, another term you'll hear. Just being in the spectacular Swiss Alps where Labrie was born and where I went to study in 1967 as a young Christian was a very moving experience for me. It brought back many memories of the early days of Labrie, of people whose stories are told in Mrs. Schaefer's book, Labrie, and some of whom I knew and still know. I'm especially reminded of the sense I had at the time as a very young Christian that Francis and Edith Schaefer were aware of the reality of the supernatural world and of their total dependence on the God who created the universe in a way that I longed to experience for myself as a very young Christian. Coming back to early April 2016, it was encouraging being with colleagues from all around the world who continue to be committed to this same supernatural reality and God. In 1955, Labrie consisted of a family of 6 with an open home, welcoming a stream of guests whom they believed God had brought to them. Since then, Labrie has grown to be an international organization with 9 branches and more structure than was necessary in the beginning. I want to say a word about the difficulty of describing Labrie. We don't fit any normal categories. We're not a school, we're not a church, we're not a retreat center. Depending on who I'm talking with, I usually describe Labrie as a residential Christian study community. And depending on their response, I fill in more details. We are less institutional and more centered in homes and overlapping with family life than a typical study center. We're a ministry of teaching and hospitality based on prayer with no regular predictable means of support. No fundraising, deputation work, or endowment. When our children were young, they hated being asked by friends or their friends' parents, "What do your parents do?" Soon after moving to Massachusetts from England, our middle son, who was in 2nd grade, had to fill out a school questionnaire which inquired, "What does your father do?" He wrote, "Nothing." It goes on, though. "He washes dishes and reads to us." Good definition of a father, I would say. A year later, the same child wrote on a similar question. He'd lived in America long enough to realize that really didn't float. The same child wrote in a similar questionnaire that his dad worked for General Motors. It was easier than describing Labrie. Our oldest son was asked by a mother in a school carpool. school, what is Labrie? And before he could open his mouth, another mother replied, it's a drug rehab facility. Our son knew that was wrong, but I'm not sure whether he tried to correct her. Interestingly, we discovered early on that among neighbors and townsfolk, the thing that they find most unsettling about us is that we welcome strangers into our home. The word hospitality, philoxenia in Greek, means loving the stranger, which in one form or another is God's calling for all of his people. That side of Labrie is a head-on challenge to the contemporary idolatry of the private home, the idea that my home is my castle. Enough introduction. This will be a very brief version of the Labrie story, its beginnings in Switzerland in the mid-1950s, and the birth of the Southborough branch in 1980. Most of what I say will have to do with the beginnings of both of these works, and there's no way in an evening talk that I could cover the Labrie story as it's continued to unfold in the years and all the places up to the present. So I'll start with a kind of preamble to the Swiss Labrie. Francis and Edith Schaefer and their three daughters, Priscilla, age 11, Susan, age 7, and Debbie, age 3, moved to Switzerland in September 1948 to do a work of teaching and encouragement in churches throughout war-torn Europe. They were particularly concerned with, in Edith's words, the philosophical and theological bombs which had torn up and scattered faith and orderly thinking, ideas which led a whole generation growing up to be taught that one might as well not even argue about what truth is, because absolute truth is non-existent. All things are relative. Children growing up unaware that any educated person could believe the Bible to be true. This was the situation in post-World War II Europe. In the beginning, the Schaefers were supported by an American mission board, and Switzerland was more a base of operation from which they traveled rather than the center of their work. Over time, this changed. While living in Champéry, in the Catholic canton or county of Valais, opportunities for local ministry gradually increased. Dr. Schaefer was asked to conduct Protestant worship services in English in a chapel that had been built many years before by an English woman. These services drew English-speaking tourists, it was ski country, after all, for Christmas and other holidays, as well as students and faculty from several private schools in the area. Soon, groups of boarding school students were coming to the Schaefer's home in the evening for cocoa and discussion. Some also came in the daytime for cooking lessons with Edith. Friends of the Schaefer children started coming as well, and soon Priscilla, who was the oldest and most fluent in French, was teaching Bible classes to local children. Increasingly, the Schaefer's home drew people from many nationalities and beliefs, people who were interested in discussing life's big questions about meaning, God, and truth. And many were coming to faith out of atheism or agnosticism. The Schaefers began to feel torn between their traveling ministry to European churches and a very busy local work centered in their home. Now, while they were thrilled to know that God was working through them, there were also trials, and there always will be trials. Throughout the mid to late 1950s and early 1960s, the family experienced periods of affliction and terrible discouragement. Their youngest child, Frankie, who is now called Frank, got polio and was partially crippled. Their daughter, Susan, came down with rheumatic fever and was bedridden on and off for a couple of years. Their home was nearly destroyed by an avalanche, which was heading directly toward them and divided just in time going around them, missing the house but causing havoc, mud and rocks everywhere. In the midst of these afflictions, they prayed and experienced God's help. For example, getting expert advice about treating polio from one of the few experts on that disease. But the trials and discouragements were real and painful and very time and energy consuming. Edith writes about these times in her book, Labrie, and noted that we never prayed for easy, but we prayed for reality. In January 1955, Edith Schaefer was reading Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. And it shall pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. And many people shall go and say, come, and let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. While reading this text, she experienced a tremendous surge of assurance that God was going to do a new work through them in these Swiss mountains, bringing people from many nations who were searching for truth. She wrote the word l'abri, which is the French word for shelter, in the margins of her Bible, next to Isaiah 2:2. On several key occasions, Edith Schaefer had experiences like this, perhaps what the New Testament calls a gift of faith for a specific thing, in contrast to the more general faith or trust which must characterize every believer's relationship with God. This is not to say that all of her strong hunches or surges of certainty over the years were always inspired by God. She regularly prayed, "If this is not from you, O Lord, you can close the door." And in fact, that happened a number of times. For example, for many months, Edith prayed with faith for money to build a large chalet with a communal dining hall. For years, the answer was no. But many years later, and I'm not sure when this happened actually, a large home for children with cerebral palsy was closed down and the chalet was given to L'Abri. Chalet Bellevue is now the main chalet and accommodates most of the students and includes a large dining area. Students still have some meals with individuals in individual family chalets, but Bellevue makes for much more flexibility. So she got her answer way later, not when she initially prayed. And it wasn't through building a building, but being given a building next door to their chalet. On Valentine's Day, 1955, the Schaefers experienced a huge crisis. This was less than a month after Edith wrote L'Abri in the margins of her Bible. They received two government edicts. One was from the canton of Valais, stating that they must leave Champéry and the entire canton by midnight of March 31st. That was 6 weeks away. The second was from Bern, the capital of Switzerland, saying that they must leave all of Switzerland by the same time, not to return for 2 years. The reason given was for having a religious influence in the village of Champéry. An important official from Champéry, who was from a Catholic background, had been converted from atheism to a Protestant understanding of the Christian faith. His conversion had caused unwelcome ripples in this Catholic county, and for that reason, the Schaefers were being evicted. All the Swiss who heard about it were amazed, exclaiming that such a thing could not happen in Switzerland, and yet it had. At this point, the Schaefer family gathered together with a house guest to pray. And Dr. Schaefer put a choice before them. I'm quoting from Edith's book here. "As I see it, there are two courses of action open to us. We could hurry to send telegrams to Christian organizations, our senator in Washington, and so on, trying to get all the human help we could possibly get. Or we could simply get down on our knees and ask God to help us. We have said that we want to have a greater reality of the supernatural power of God in our lives and in our work. It seems to me that we've been given an opportunity right now to demonstrate God's power. Do we believe God is able to do something in government offices in this present situation as he was able to in times past? Do we believe our God is the God of Daniel? If so, we have an opportunity to prove it now." Edith continues, "So we chose to pray rather than telegraph frantically for help. And we knelt down as a family with our one curious onlooker. And we prayed, each one out loud, one at a time, right down to little Frankie." The reality of the supernatural is a theme that recurs throughout the L'Abri story. During the previous years in Switzerland, Frances Schaefer had gone through a very real crisis of faith. Before moving to Europe, he had been a very successful pastor of a growing church in St. Louis. But while in Europe, he was struck by a sense of the lack of reality of the supernatural in their lives. He asked himself and his family, how different would our lives be in any practical sense if we woke up tomorrow to find that all of the promises about prayer and the Holy Spirit had been removed from the Bible? Would it make any practical difference in our lives? Over the course of many months, Dr. Schaefer had paced back and forth in a barn, wrestling with questions about the truth of the Bible and the Christian faith. He determined to abandon the faith and live consistently as an atheist if he concluded that Christianity was not really true in the most solid sense. In other words, true to what actually exists, not true in some subjective, spiritual, or otherworldly sense. But if he came to the certainty that the Christian faith was true, then he determined by God's grace to depend on God and live in the reality of the supernatural in a way that he had not done before. This is the background to the Schaeffer's family decision to depend on God in prayer for this eviction notice, rather than to try to start pulling whatever strings they could think of. The immediate story that follows is one of God working together details in answer to prayer that, in a way that no human being could have been able to orchestrate. I don't have time to repeat all of them, but an amazing series of events unfolded. I'll just mention a few. They discovered from a Swiss friend who examined the documents that they had only 36 hours to appeal the edicts. They were told to report their situation to the senior consul at the U.S. Embassy in Bern. When they went to meet him, to their amazement, he turned out to be a high school classmate of Francis Schaeffer's from Philadelphia. Two sympathetic sisters who were neighbors nodded their heads over the Schaeffer's plight and said, "We must tell our brother." Now, Switzerland is governed by a council of seven, and the presidency rotates between them. It turned out that their brother was the equivalent of the president of Switzerland that year. So he was actually in a position to help. Three of their friends just happened to be friends with the chief of the Bureau des Etrangers, which is the equivalent of the Bureau of Immigration. And they determined to talk to him about the Schaeffer's plight. The Schaeffer's discovered that the only way they could appeal the edict was to find another specific house with an address to move into in a Protestant county. And this had to be done in a couple of days. So the next challenge was to find a house. The family and friends prayed, and they searched for a house in the neighboring Protestant canton of Vaud. They were down to the last few hours of the allotted time, and they still couldn't find a house. Francis Schaeffer gave up and went home to start packing. But Edith was determined to find a house. Finally, in desperation, she knelt down in the snow and started to pray with a different spirit, asking that God would forgive her attitude of willful determination and make her submissive to his will, even if it meant to live in a city slum and not in these Swiss Alps. Suddenly, while praying, she felt again a surge of faith in the God of Elijah, Daniel, and Joseph. And she prayed, I'm quoting, "But God, if you want us to stay in Switzerland, if your word to me concerning Le Brie means our being here in these mountains, then I know you were able to find a house and lead me to it in the next half hour." That was all the time they had left. "Nothing is impossible for you, but you will have to do it because I can't even talk to anyone without breaking down in tears." Just then, she heard her name called and looked up to see a real estate agent she had spoken to earlier. He said he thought he'd found a place and drove her down the mountain to the next village, a tiny farming village called Huemo. The house did look suitable, but when she asked about the rent, the realtor said, as he drove off, "Oh, it's not for rent, it's for sale." And her heart sank because they had no money to buy a house with. On the way home, as Edith prayed, she again became flooded with a surge of assurance that God can do anything. She writes, "I ended my prayer with a definite plea, which even startled me as I asked it. Oh, please show us your will about this house tomorrow, and if we are to buy it, send us a sign that will be clear enough to convince Fran as well as me. Send us $1,000 before 10 o'clock tomorrow morning." She persuaded Dr. Schaeffer to come look at the chalet the next morning, but didn't dare tell him it was for sale. The next morning, the postman handed them three letters, which they read together on the train en route to look at Chalet Les Malaises. One was from an American couple, the Salisburys, and contained a check for $1,000. The letter described how the husband had received a bonus at work. For 3 months, they had thought and prayed about what to do with the extra money. They considered buying a new car or investing in a house or giving it to another Christian work. Then one night, they both felt certain they should send it to the Schaeffers to, quote, "to buy a house somewhere that will always be open to young people." While praying, the wife felt certain they must not wait until the morning to mail it, but should drive to the post office right away, even though it was midnight and pouring with rain. She felt it must go out in the earliest morning post. And that, in fact, was the only way the money got to the Schaeffers in time. It was an amazing example of God's timing in answer to the prayers of the Salisburys and also the Schaefers. They felt this gift was only the last in a series of markers or signposts leading them one step at a time, with no sure knowledge of the future, to the work that would become Libri. On the strength of that gift and what they understood to be God's clear guidance, they took the next step of faith and signed for the house, committing themselves to a down payment of about $7,000 cash. Edith writes, over a two-month period of time, about 157 gifts came from very scattered places on the earth's surface. The smallest gift was $1, and except for that first gift of $1,000, the largest was $225. The total came to exactly $7,343.30. When the math was finished, it was within $3 of what they needed. The bank gave them the mortgage, and the amount to be paid monthly toward the mortgage payments would be less than any rent they could have found in that section of the mountains. Amazingly enough, she writes, not one gift came late. From that time on, not another gift came to us designated for the buying of a house. Money had a different kind of value back then, I'm thinking. The establishment of Libri Fellowship. And this is really their decision to start a new work. After the dramatic provision of the money for the down payment on Chalet Les Malaises, the Schaefers felt that God was calling them not only to a new location in Switzerland, but also to a new work. Edith Schaefer writes, as June 4th, 1955 came, only 5 days after the payment had been made, we reached a decision. Rather than having the buying of the chalet become a full stop to the last paragraph of a chapter, we felt it must be the opening of a new chapter altogether. So we sat down and resigned from the mission board under which we served and from which we had received a monthly salary. We stated that we believed the Lord was leading us to establish Libri Fellowship. Had we gone crazy with responsibilities just taken on for mortgage payments, with one daughter in university and three children at home, what did we expect to live on and to feed ourselves with? This is what we felt we were being led to do, to ask God that our work and our lives be a demonstration that He does exist, not just for 6 weeks, not for 3 months, but for as long as He should continue to lead us to live in this manner. At that time, the Schaefers set forth four principles for the operation of Libri, and these four principles remain foundational to Libri in all the branches. The first principle is we pray that God will bring the people of His choice to Libri and keep others away. This was a decision not to advertise for people to come. When I was a student at the Swiss Libri in 1967, I overlapped with some Malaysians who had heard about Libri independently from each other and found their way to the tiny village of Waymo in the Swiss Alps. Over the course of many months, more Malaysians kept coming. And as far as I know, all of them were converted to Christ and were baptized at Libri. They dared not return home because it was their family's duty to kill any family members who converted away from Islam. That summer, there was also a group of Africans who were studying at a university in Russia. This was during the Cold War, and we knew one of them was a spy. I'm not sure whether the spy was ever identified, but he was there. It was also the summer of an arts festival. Professor Hans Ruckmacher, founder of the Dutch Libri and a professor of art history at the Free University of Amsterdam, was at the Swiss Libri to lecture and lead discussions. 130 people were at Libri that week, crammed into a few chalets. Soon after, the Swiss government intervened and restricted the number to about 30 people on the basis of the cubic meters of air volume in each bedroom. This is extremely Swiss way of thinking. They measured the cubic meters of air volume and then told the Libri members how many people were allowed to come. In fact, that restriction probably saved Libri, or certainly saved the workers from rapidly burning out. Having 130 guests could not have been sustained for long. Much has changed since 1955. For example, there are books, conferences, and films. And Libri has a website, which gives information about the work. However, the principle remains that we do not advertise for people. You will not see an ad for Libri in Christianity Today or any other Christian magazine. You see ads for all sorts of Christian colleges and institutions. You will not see one for Libri. Most people still hear about us by word of mouth, but others come across the website and decide to come. As in the beginning, we pray for God to bring those of His choice, and we marvel at some of the stories of how they learned about Libri. We also very intentionally welcome people with the belief that they are the ones that God has brought us. The second principle that the Schaeffers decided on. We pray that God will provide the money needed for the work of Libri to carry on. For the Schaeffers in 1955, this meant provisions for a family and their guests, a family of six and their guests. In 2016, it means provisions for the workers and their families and guests, whom we call students and helpers, in nine branches: Switzerland, the Netherlands, England, two branches in the United States, Southborough and Rochester, Minnesota, South Korea, Brazil, Canada, and Australia. It includes prayers for the provision and maintaining of properties in all of these places. And we now charge a fee which covers a relatively small percentage of the cost. We continue to pray for God's provision of money and other things, and most comes from these unsolicited gifts. The third principle, we pray for God to unfold His plan for the work in each branch, rather than establishing committees to do long-range strategic planning. And as we look back at the beginning, God has led Libri in a way that reflects both continuity and innovation. We see no virtue in doing things exactly the way they've always been done, as long as new developments remain faithful to our core foundational principles. As I mentioned earlier, when Libri consisted of one family with an open home, there was less need for structure. Most branches now have a structure of half a day study and a half a day of work for our students. As branches have started in different countries, the work has taken slightly different shapes, depending on location and need and the people who are working there. For example, in the Netherlands, there is a large residential country branch and also a city work which caters to local people, including students, who come for an evening film discussion or other event, but they don't stay for weeks or months. In our recent international members meetings, we discussed some of the ways in which the Utrecht branch has changed and ideas for expanding its outreach to the city of Utrecht. I mention this because it's important to understand that trusting God for His plan does not mean only praying and doing nothing. It means praying and brainstorming, sharing thoughts and ideas, praying again, and trying new ways to serve God better as the culture shifts at different times and places. It also includes thanking God for leading us as we recognize His providence overseeing our decisions and activities. The fourth principle, we pray for the workers of God's choice in each branch. And we still follow an early principle that requires every worker to come first as a student for at least one term, and then become a helper for one or two terms before applying to become a worker. This is to protect hopeful workers as well as the work. In fact, there's no way for a person to know whether he or she will fit well with the work of Libri until they've been in a branch for a while. And there's no way for the team in any branch to know how well an aspiring worker may fit in until they've been there for a while. Many have read Mrs. Schaeffer's book, thought, I really want to work in Libri, and then they come and stay for a while, and they say, I really don't want to work in Libri. It's not for everyone. Obviously, prayer is central to the work of Libri. It's important to say that neither the Schaeffers nor any workers since then have ever felt that it is more spiritual to pray for financial needs rather than asking for support or working for a salary. A common and important theme in Paul's letters is his strong encouragement, one could even say at times arm-twisting, to the Gentile churches to give money to support the Jewish Christians who were suffering from famine in Jerusalem. There's nothing intrinsically unspiritual about fundraising. The calling to depend on God in prayer has been a very specific calling of Libri, part of the way we have hoped, in Eva Schaeffer's words, to demonstrate in our life and work the existence of God. I want to say another word about the centrality of prayer. In the very beginning of the work, one of the Schaeffer children suggested that in order to be sure that they really did pray to God for their needs, they ought to set aside one day of prayer each week. So they wrote out a prayer list with blocks of time for each person to sign up for and had someone praying throughout the day. In all the branches, Monday is still a day of prayer, a time to sing together and corporately thank God for his faithfulness and pray for our needs and the needs of our students and helpers. From the beginning, the Shapers and now all the branches have also set aside days for fasting and prayer. In Southborough, we used to do this only when we felt particular needs, for example, low finances or low student numbers. However, we've recently decided to have days of fasting and prayer more regularly. From the beginning, there has also been a praying family scattered around the world, people who commit to praying for Libri on a regular basis. We send out a prayer letter to those who've committed to pray for Libri, as well as a more general newsletter to others. I remember Francis Schaeffer saying on several occasions that his prayer for his own life had been, in the words of Proverbs 30, verse 8, "Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God." In a similar spirit, Schaeffer prayed for Libri that it would never become so established as a self-perpetuating, financially secure institution that God could not end it the moment it stopped serving his purposes. He believed, as we all do, that it is the church that God has established to remain until Christ returns. Other Christian organizations, including Libri, need to see themselves as serving Christ's church, existing for as long as God can use them in service of his kingdom. Mrs. Schaeffer writes about God's unfolding plan for the work, and she tells many stories of how this happened in the early history of Libri. I'll just mention two examples that she gives. The birth of the so-called tape ministry. Initially, all of the teaching happened as informal, spontaneous discussion with house guests, often over meals or tea. Early on, Dr. Schaeffer exclaimed he would never, under any circumstances, allow these very real discussions to be recorded, since that would make the whole atmosphere artificial. One day, a businessman sent the Schaeffers a tape recorder. It sat in its box, unopened and unused, for several months. Then one evening, when Dr. Schaeffer was engaged in a lively discussion with some university students, one of the guests left the room, quietly unpacked the tape recorder, asked Edith Schaeffer to cause a commotion by bringing in a tray of tea so he could secretly hide a microphone in a flower pot and tape the discussion without Dr. Schaeffer knowing. The students were thrilled to hear the tape the next day and to be able to take it back to college and share with their friends. As Mrs. Schaeffer points out, rather than planning this, they recognized God's hand leading them to a new expansion of their ministry. From that humble beginning began Libri's so-called tape ministry, first on reel-to-reels, then cassettes, CDs, now MP3s, podcasts, and Libri Ideas, where lectures can be downloaded from the website. The second example I'll give of God's unfolding his plan is the birth of the branch in England. Mrs. Schaeffer traces the beginning of the English branch of Libri not to a decision of the Libri leadership, but to the gift of airline tickets sent to them by a young English woman who had spent time in their home. She sent them tickets to London with the request that they come to England for a week so that she and other Brits who had spent time in Switzerland could bring friends to meet and talk with them in London. That was the first of many trips to England. Before long, Dr. Schaeffer was speaking at universities throughout Britain, and eventually an apartment was rented as a Libri base in London. In the years following, Libri had a profound impact on Christian artists in Britain. The art historian Hans Rookmacher, founder of Dutch Libri, traveled frequently to London where he influenced and encouraged the work of Christians in film, theater and television, the visual and graphic arts, dance and music. He was instrumental in the birth of the Arts Center Group, at the time headed up by Nigel Goodwin, which I believe continues today. I'm not sure if it's under the same name. In 1964, a large house was given to Libri in Ealing, on the western outskirts of London. It became the London Libri, where the Schaeffer's daughter Susan and her husband Ranald Macaulay lived and worked until 1970. At that time, a large English manor house was given to LaBrie in Greenham, Hampshire, and the Macaulays left London to found a residential branch there. Dick was just finishing theological study in the States, and we replaced the Macaulays in the London work in December 1970. We lived there for 8 years, working for LaBrie and pastoring a church that initially met in the house. I'll pick up our story a bit later. In the years since the purchase of Chalet Les Malaises, other chalets have been added, and a stream of people have gone to study and to work at Swiss LaBrie. Edith Schaefer's book, LaBrie, covers much of that story, going up to the beginning of the work in Ealing in London. And by God's grace, the story still continues to unfold in Switzerland and many other countries. Before moving on to talk about the birth of this branch, I want to say something to, I don't know if this is the word, de-romanticize or unromanticize the idea of life in LaBrie. Dramatic answers to prayer, such as Edith recounts in her book, are really exciting. But she also writes of crises and turmoil, including, as I mentioned, a child with polio, another with rheumatic fever, guests with disabilities, a child with sunstroke, avalanches, so on. They experience fluctuating faith and despair, praying and waiting, and often experiencing God's responses at the very last minute. Throughout the ups and downs, people were continually coming to stay with them. Most of them were non-Christians, asking questions like, is there any purpose in life? Is there meaning in the universe? Where does personality come from? Their discussions took place not in an ivory tower classroom setting, but in the midst of a family with all of the challenges I've described and more. It was a household where food needed preparing, dishes and laundry needed washing, gardens needed digging and planting, sick children and guests had to be cared for, and where prayer was part of the work and roof of daily life. And hospitality was costly. All of the Schaefer's wedding presents were broken within a couple of years of LaBrie life. Reality also included the fact that they and their guests were all very imperfect people who made mistakes and sometimes hurt each other. LaBrie has never been heaven on earth. This real-life context demonstrated that what the Schaefer's described as Christian truth was not dry doctrines from an old irrelevant book. It had to do with a living, personal, and infinitely powerful creator, a God who cared for fallen individuals and heard their prayers in the midst of a very imperfect world. As Edith wrote, they were seeking reality, not ease. And reality in this world is always messy. My ears are popping. When Dick went to LaBrie in 1965, soon after graduating from university, he was challenged for the first time to consider the truth and relevance of the Christian faith. The intellectual discussions he was part of were inseparable from the daily demonstrations of the reality of the unseen world. It was virtually impossible for him to think about truth, philosophy, or theology as purely academic subjects. I want to move now to talk about the beginning of this branch, the South Brew, Massachusetts branch. And some way back background to start, years back before Francis and Edith Schaefer moved to Europe, they both had a particular concern for New England and thought they might one day work here. At the time, there were few good churches or plausible Christian voices for truth in New England. And the New England colleges and universities and the media were influential sources of skepticism, undermining confidence in biblical truth well beyond the northeastern part of the United States. More recent background, in 1964 to 65, in an effort to avoid being drafted to go to Vietnam, Dick Kies enrolled in a French university. He was not a conscientious objector, but just too confused about Vietnam to want to risk his life there. While in Europe, he decided to check out the Swiss LaBrie, which he'd heard about from a lecturer at Harvard who he used to lift weights with. Dick was from a thoroughly secular background, but while in college, he met an Episcopal minister who challenged him to think about Jesus and the claims of the Bible. He'd made some response of faith, but almost immediately, questions and doubts flooded in, and he regretted this step of faith. So during his year in Europe, he made numerous trips to LaBrie, read the Bible for the first time, and spent hours conversing with Francis Schaeffer and others. He particularly wrestled with questions of morality, what basis is there for morality, and human nature. Gradually, Dick became convinced that Christianity was true, again, not in some subjective, otherworldly, spiritual sense, but true in the sense that it explained reality accurately, including the dual nature of human beings, even himself. As Francis Schaeffer put it, human beings are glorious ruins. Glorious because as images of God, we are capable of extraordinary greatness, heroism, love, courage, self-sacrifice, creativity, etc. But also ruins because as rebels against our Creator, humans are proud, arrogant, self-centered, self-deceived, and capable of unthinkable evil and cruelty. After many months of wrestling with the biblical worldview and the claims of Jesus, Dick came to faith in a much more wholehearted, whole-minded way than before. Schaeffer often said that in becoming a Christian, a person needs to bow twice. Once in recognition of one's finiteness, mortality, and dependence on God for everything, including the breath we breathe. And second, we bow in recognition of our very real moral guilt, which is the thing that separates us from our Creator. Part of this bowing involves the humility of acknowledging that there's nothing we can do to earn our own salvation. All we can offer is empty hands lifted up to receive the free gift of forgiveness and reconciliation with God, which was paid for by Jesus the Messiah. He lived the righteous life that none of us are capable of living, and he bore God's judgment in our place for our sin on the cross. This is why the Christian gospel is such good news, but also why it is such an affront to human pride. After becoming a Christian, Dick had a strong longing to see something like Le Brie established in New England, a place where the compatibility of intellectual integrity and belief in the biblical worldview could be demonstrated and lived out in a community setting. At about the same time, in 1963, I became a Christian through a history teacher who'd been converted 7 years earlier during her trips to Le Brie from Swiss University, where she studied with Priscilla Schaeffer, their oldest daughter. I hadn't met Dick yet, but ironically or providentially or both, Judy, the teacher who spoke to me, was the sister of the man, Joe Brown, who first told Dick about Le Brie while they lifted weights together at university. During the summer between my junior and senior year in college, I studied at Le Brie and brought a couple of non-Christian friends with me. I had the same frustration Dick did, not knowing anywhere closer than Switzerland, where I could encourage my agnostic and atheist friends to go. I had a longing to see something like Le Brie set up in New England. Dick and I met in 1965. We were married soon after my college graduation in 1968. Dick was studying theology at Westminster Seminary, and after his graduation in 1970, we moved to Europe to work with Le Brie. We spent 3 months in Switzerland, where our first son, Christopher, was born. And early in 1971, we moved to London, where we lived in a Le Brie house and wore two hats. We were Le Brie workers, and Dick was pastor of the International Presbyterian Church, which met in our house. While in London, our two younger sons, Tim and Ben, were born. Late in the 1970s, we sensed a call back to the United States, and particularly to New England. When we raised this at a members' meeting, Mrs. Schaeffer asked us if we felt called to leave Le Brie or whether it was more positive call to this part of the world, to New England. We said it was the latter. We felt a call. We wanted to be closer to our families, and we felt called to New England, and we were sad to be leaving Le Brie. Shortly after that meeting, we got an excited phone call from Edith Schaeffer saying that a woman from Massachusetts had just called her and wanted to buy a property for Le Brie in New England. Dick and I were about to fly home for vacation, so we arranged to meet with this woman. When we met her, to our amazement, we discovered that her uncle, whose house she thought of giving Le Brie, had been one of my grandfather's closest university friends. Uncle Duncan was my father's godfather and a good friend of my parents. They'd actually been in the home that she wanted to give to Le Brie. We and our Le Brie colleagues agreed that our family should spend a year at the large residential branch at the Gretham Le Brie in Gretham, England, in preparation for starting a residential work in the States. The timing was right as a family was leaving the work there, enabling us to move into the converted stables. That was the spring of 1978. I want to say a word about God's leading. How did we know the time was right to start a residential branch in the United States? Over the years, LaBrie had had many offers of properties in the United States, and we had said no to all these offers of property. The three factors came together this time to convince the LaBrie members that it was time to say yes. Our 9 years in England were coming to an end, and we were already planning on coming back to New England. It was the first time there were experienced LaBrie workers who were in a position to leave a European branch and set up a new branch in the United States. Property is obviously necessary, but experienced personnel are absolutely essential. At exactly this time, a woman offered to buy us a property in New England. And then the entire LaBrie membership was agreed that this was the right time to start a branch here. As we all prayed individually and corporately, the Lord seemed to confirm to us this decision to go forward. And part of this confirmation came in the willingness of Barry and Veronica Segrin from the Swiss LaBrie to accompany us in this new venture. When the time came to move here, the entire membership circled around the four of us, laid hands on us, praying and ordaining us to come to Massachusetts and start a new branch of LaBrie. Then once we knew this woman would buy a property, we had the challenge of finding a house. Soon after leaving the London work to join the Gretham LaBrie, we got a call from Francis Schaefer, encouraging us to fly to Massachusetts to look at a property that he'd heard of that might be suitable. So we contacted Dick's parents, who lived in Pepperell, Mass., just north of here, asked them to do some real estate sleuthing for us so that we could look at several places when we made the trip. We flew to Massachusetts in July 1978 and looked at four properties. I remember the Schaefer's son-in-law, Ranald McCauley, telling me that we would know when we found the right house. In each case, it took a lot of imagination, trying to picture where families would live, where students would sleep, what would make a good study space, a good lecture room, etc. Having looked at several unsuitable properties, which really strained our imagination, when we got to this house, 49 Lindbrook Road, it really did feel like the right place. It was beautiful and very well built, and with some changes, it could serve LaBrie's needs very well. I might add here that beauty is something that all of us in LaBrie treasure, believe in and treasure. God is the source of all beauty, and we honor him when we express beauty in the broadest sense in our lives and surroundings. God has blessed all the branches with homes in beautiful settings. And there's research showing that even the simplest care for beauty, some flowers in a window box, a candle on the table, caring food preparation and presentation, original artwork by children or people of any age, but original artwork, people who care for their small apartments and plots of land, city parks or vegetable plots in the city, can help transform individuals, families, and city neighborhoods, lowering the rates of vandalism and crime. Beauty, which I will definitely not try to define, is a deeply human longing and need, because we're made in the image of the God who is the source of all beauty. Edith Schaefer's book, Hidden Art, expands on this theme with lots of practical ideas. I was reminded of this book recently by one of our students who's read it and found it very helpful. Back to our search for a property. In her book, LaBrie, Edith frequently uses the phrase signposts or pointers to indicate some of the ways she felt God confirmed the direction they should take. And we experienced some of these in finding this house. When Dick's father initially found this house, he recognized it as the home of his rowing coach when he was a student at St. Mark's School in Southborough. He used to come here for Sunday lunches with the rest of his crew team when it was a house full of oriental carpets and antique furniture and so on. Dick's aunt had also known the family who lived here and frequently come to parties in this room with her family. The first time we looked through the house, most of the rooms were empty and the house looked very forlorn. When I walked into one of the upstairs bedrooms, the room we use for couples now, the only thing in the room was a book lying upside down on the floor. I picked it up, turned it over, and to my astonishment, it was Francis Schaefer's book, Joshua and the Flow of History. I have no idea how it got there, who was reading it, whatever. But I felt it was some kind of signpost. The woman who offered to buy the house for LaBrie agreed that it was a good property and a very good price. She was willing to purchase the house for LaBrie. However, at this point, as Dick says, the plot thickened. We had to get permission from the town to make certain changes to the house in order to do the work we envisioned. This included putting in extra kitchens, something which was suspect in a town with strict zoning laws to prevent apartment buildings. The religious organization that was selling the house was very unpopular with the town. Among other things, they were non-compliant with the town's fire regulations. When confronted about that, they said, "We don't need to obey your laws. God will protect us from fire." You can imagine that very day, the town officially shut them down. We realized how important it was that we be entirely above board and honest in all of our dealings with the town of Southboro. We needed to present detailed before and after floor plans. We experienced the Lord's provision in leading us to an engineer in a local church who was willing to spend many evenings measuring and drawing up plans as a gift to LaBrie. Our generous donor made an offer on the house pending acceptance of the site plan by the town. It took 3 months to discover exactly what the town demanded and to get our plans passed by the Board of Health, the fire department, the building inspector, and so on. In total, Dick made 6 round-trip flights across the Atlantic from the time we first found the property in July 1978 to the passing of papers in October 1978. But we had a number of encouraging signposts, in Mr. Schaefer's words, in the midst of seemingly endless hassles. On one of Dick's first trips to the town hall, he was told that he would need to talk with the building inspector, who was out of his office at the time. Dick was hungry, so he went down to the local spa for lunch. He started chatting with the man sitting next to him and described what had brought him to Southboro. To his surprise, the man said, "I am the building inspector. I'm the one you need to talk with." This story reminded us of some of the kinds of encouragements the Schaefer's experienced in the early days of Swiss LaBrie. What turned out to be an extremely important factor in the town allowing us to build family units into this house was the fact that 2 private schools in town had recently gotten a zoning variance for new multi-purpose buildings. The variance allowed them to house classrooms, student accommodations, and faculty housing all under one roof. There was no way we could have known this ahead of time, but God knew that our necessary structural changes to the house would be acceptable to the town only because they fit with the zoning variance established by 2 schools not long before we came here. When we talked to the fire chief, we discovered that if the house had been 3 floors high, we would have had to put in a sprinkler system, which was enormously expensive and would make a mess of the house. But a 2-floor house only required a fire alarm system. It just so happened that we learned of this while a couple named the Zimmermans were studying with us at the Gretham LaBrie in England. Mr. Zimmerman was in the fire alarm business, and he gave LaBrie all of the best industrial quality equipment we needed as a gift. So we only had to pay to have it installed in this house. This seemed another encouraging signpost. At a town hearing to which anyone in town could come and object to LaBrie opening in Southboro, we were very thankful to meet a number of people who were very positive to LaBrie, who knew of LaBrie, were very positive and had come to support us. And in fact, by that time, all the town officials were very positive toward us as well, thanks in part to Dick's many respectful and cooperative interactions with them. We never regretted all the time and airline flights that were necessary to establish ourselves in a good and honest relationship with the town. We also thank God in hindsight for his timing of the final purchase of the property. The closing took place on October 19th, 1978. Very soon after that, the world was shocked by the horrific story of the religious cult in Jonestown, where out of loyalty to their leader, Jim Jones, his followers committed mass suicide, even poisoning their own children. We felt sure that given the town's understandable edginess about religious cults, it might well have been impossible for us to get permission to open a branch of LaBrie in Southboro if it had been after that Jonestown horror story. We've also been extremely thankful for good relationships with neighbors, going right back to Dick's first visit with Phil Jacobs, our abutter and former owner of this house. He had sold it to the religious group that we bought it from and moved next door to a lovely old house, which unfortunately has subsequently been torn down. And there's now new big houses going in. When Dick initially called Phil to ask him some questions about the town, there was a silence on the other end of the phone. Then Phil asked him, "What makes you so sure I want you to be my neighbor?" Dick tells you something about this character. Dick acknowledged, "Oh, of course, you don't know me from Adam. Why would you want me to be your neighbor? But can I come around and meet you, and can we talk?" So Dick spent that evening with Phil, after which Phil called him back and said, "Dick, I decided I do want you to be my neighbor, and I want to be of help to you in any way I can." He was true to his word for the rest of his life. Among other things, he gave us free manure, which we are very grateful for our gardens. He also hired two of our sons when they were old enough to do work on his property. And he also called us for help. He called us at times to move rocks, and one time he called because he had one of his horses was cast, which means it was down, and it couldn't get up. And a horse can get down and not get up by itself. So Dick, Barry, and our students all trooped down to Phil Jacobs and managed to lift the horse up, get the horse back on his feet.
In the middle of breakfast.
In the middle of breakfast. Sorry, he called him Dick, my heart, I got a cast horse. Can you send some people down to get him up? Years later, Phil asked Dick, "Do you do marrying down there?" Pointing to that. "Do you do marrying?" He asked Dick to marry him to his common-law wife of many years, and they were married right in front of the fireplace in this library just about a year before he died. We were also thankful for the many friends of Libri who encouraged us by giving their time and labor during our first year in Southborough. There were endless, unglamorous work to be done to make the place livable for our families and to meet the town's requirements for having students and holding meetings. When we got here, while the house was empty, a pipe had burst here and poured down into lots of Dick's books, which were in boxes on the floor. The ceiling needed to be scraped numerous times, and there were people here scraping ceilings and repairing things, and just tremendously helpful. And over the years, a number of families have also moved to be near Libri, who've been a huge support to us in many, many different ways. I think specifically the Colemans, the Littles, and the Larsons, some of whom those who are students will meet. One of our first helpers here was Judy Ward. Dick and I remember well when she and Linny Dye, who both formerly worked at the Swiss Libri, talked and prayed with us about their dream to start a classical Christian school. In 1981, the Imago School opened with 13 students. Now, in 2016, according to the website, there are 90 students. Nikki may know if that's correct. Or Danny may know. 90 students, ranging from kindergarten through 8th grade. Our colleagues, Joe and Sue Morell, sent their boys, Luke and Nate, to Imago. And Ben and Michaela's twins, Ellie and Abby, who are here tonight, are going to Imago now. Linny Dye frequently lectures for us, and Imago recently hired Danny Burbeck, a former worker in this branch and also in the English Libri. We're thankful for such a fruitful, ongoing relationship with Imago that began with both of our works were in their birth pangs. We're just starting up. Moving in. In May 1979, Barry and Veronica Segrin with their three young children and our family of five moved into 49 Limbrook Road. Dick and I remember vividly how overwhelmed we felt everywhere we looked. Dick brought a box of tools down from his parents' house from Pepperell. But every job required three or four prior jobs with equipment or supplies we didn't have. We discovered after the sun went down the first night that in the whole house there were virtually no working light bulbs. Maybe there was one. The family living in the house had simply moved working bulbs where needed, never replacing any of the dead ones. The outsides of most of the windows in the apartment upstairs had been spray painted. It drove me crazy, so one of the first things I did was get a ladder, climb up, and just scrape paint off the windows so I could see out the windows. In the beginning, the two families shared one kitchen with one dying stove. Eventually, only one burner worked. Some friends had given us a piano, not this one. This was Edith Schaefer's beautiful Steinway piano, which was a gift to us a few years ago. The piano that was given to us is now in Ben's basement. But some friends had given us a piano, and there were no rugs or curtains to muffle the sound when one or more of the six young children banged on it. There was also a buzzer system, originally intended so that servants could be buzzed from anywhere in the house. The children delighted in using the buzzer system. The noise of the piano and the buzzers reverberated throughout the house until Barry disabled the buzzer system. We were not allowed to have students come until we'd made some major changes on the house to meet building codes. Two staircases for means of egress in case of fire, a fire alarm system, a septic system rebuilt, and so on. We also had changes to make for our own purposes. Barry Segrin's carpentry and design skills were invaluable. Among many other things, he transformed the master bathroom into a kitchen for the upstairs worker family, us at the time and now the Chestnuts. We also had to hire people to do work on the house. After talking with many builders and contractors, we found Al Macquarie, who had great respect for this old house. He's an excellent builder and came to love LaBrie. Several years later, he built a new house in the field opposite the big house. When Al and his wife took a trip to Europe, they made a point of stopping at the Swiss LaBrie. In 1980, we were finally completed enough work on the house for the town to allow us to have 8 students. We had an opening service to which many friends of LaBrie came, including the builder, the plumber, the electrician, the building inspector, and all of their families. Dr. Schaefer, whose father had been a mason, gave a very moving talk. This took place soon after the death of the infant of a worker couple, Larry and Nancy Snyder, and the death of Dick's 4-year-old niece. We were all really shaken by the deaths of those 2 children. And Schaefer's topic was the dust of death and the dust of life, reflecting on the fact that in a fallen world, the dust of death is everywhere. But because of the victory of Jesus over death, the dust of life is also everywhere and will prevail. I believe this talk is available, if not on MP3, then maybe on cassette tape, not sure. One of the most thrilling things to me was the response of the men who had worked on the house. They absolutely loved Schaefer. The electrician, who was also the town wiring inspector, was so impressed and moved by Dr. Schaefer's talk that he finished the rest of the electrical work at no charge. It was also a tremendous encouragement having together in one room so many long-term friends of LaBrie from the New England area. These were people who started praying for this work as soon as they learned that there would be a branch in Massachusetts. And many of them also helped us with all of the practical work that first year. A while later, we finally finished all the necessary work and the town of Southborough allowed us our full number of students. Even though we had a real sense of confidence that God had led us here and provided wonderfully for us, we had many discouragements, even as the Schaefers had. Within a few months of arriving in Massachusetts, I had minor surgery, and our son Tim was admitted to Boston Children's Hospital for major kidney surgery. He was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And it was not easy getting the work underway. Dick often describes the difficulty of getting some momentum going in the work, of getting inertia working on your side. There were so many things to decide and establish for the first time. There were precedents from other branches, but also the need to be sensitive and flexible in our situation and not assume that things must be exactly the same in every branch. Following the unfolding of God's plan would not mean exactly the same thing in Switzerland, England, the Netherlands, and Massachusetts. The students who have come to Southborough have been from many different backgrounds and countries. Whereas the Swiss LaBrie initially attracted a large percentage of atheists and agnostics, wrestling with questions of truth and meaning. Once LaBrie became known in the Christian world, many from Christian backgrounds of one kind or another started to come to all the branches. Many come with questions and doubts. Some come having already chucked the faith they grew up with, but wanting to examine it from the outside. Some come with specific questions. For example, how can God be good and all-powerful in a world with so much evil? Or questions about the reliability and plausibility of the Bible, or about marriage, about sexuality. Many come seeking vocational direction, or wanting help relating their faith to their family life or their field of work, maybe an artist or lawyer or teacher or doctor or architect or anything, but wanting to think through their faith and how it relates to their life, or wanting to better understand our present culture and how to share their faith with non-believing friends and family. There's not time to include many stories of people who've come here, but I've decided to tell you one story. Mrs. Schaefer has lots of stories in this book of people who came there in the early days. But I'm just going to tell you this one story. Early in Southborough's history, a Vietnam veteran named Billy came here. He had thrown out his faith, divorced his wife, and was suicidal. Billy was covered in tattoos. He was a big guy, covered in tattoos and black leather, and was frankly a pretty scary-looking guy. He was racked with guilt for things he had done in Vietnam and spent many hours talking with Dick. Billy happened to be with us during a difficult time in our work when we came to the conclusion for a number of reasons that our two worker families could not continue working together. It was decided that our colleagues would move to work in the English Library. Soon after this decision was made, one of our colleagues explained to the students what was happening and admitted very simply and frankly that while there were good reasons for their moving, sin and failure were also real factors in the two couples not being able to continue working together. Billy sat on the sofa in this room, listening with tears streaming down his face. He told us that he had never heard a Christian leader admit failure, and it blew him away. This turned out to be a turning point for him. He came back to the Lord. He experienced grace and forgiveness in place of guilt. He was reconciled to his wife and three children and asked Dick to remarry them, which he did in this room. The family moved to Worcester for a time. Billy became a kind of chaplain to a motorcycle gang. And later, he and his wife started a ministry on Bourbon Street in New Orleans. Sadly, Billy died of a heart attack a couple of years ago. But I've never forgotten that story. And the main reason I tell it is to point out the importance, the incredible importance of integrity in individual Christians' lives and in Christian ministry, including honesty about failure in our lives. We do not protect our witness with pretense, by pretending we never make mistakes. It's really bizarre. Christians have such a strong doctrine of sin, but when it comes to admitting specific sin and failure, we often have a really hard time. And yet, that does not actually honor God. It does not make the gospel more credible. God's grace to bring healing and hope is very real in our lives and in the lives of others when we face failure with humility and honesty. Billy experienced this, and so have we, in a strong continuing friendship with our former colleagues, who we very much appreciate, and they appreciate us. I want to speak now about the need to expand. After 4 years of living and working in this big house, two families of five each, a single worker, Susan McNabb, who later married Bill Latimer, and they worked here, sundry animals, and up to as many as 18 students, we were feeling cramped. This was especially so for our family because the upstairs apartment was a difficult layout for children coming into their teen years. To get to their bedrooms or the bathroom, the children had to walk through the living dining area where we served all our student meals. And in those days, we served half the meals because there were only two worker families here. There wasn't the privacy our kids needed at critical times. With hindsight, we realized that we'd made a mistake in serving all of our meals in the apartment. We should have been much more careful about protecting our children's privacy when they returned from school. This would have meant one parent serving evening meals in the library while the other parent had supper with the children in the apartment. That has been my one piece of advice to other families with children who've lived in the upstairs apartment. Just as we were acutely feeling the need for more space, the woman who had bought this big house for LaBrie said to Dick, "I think you need to expand, and it will be easier for you to do so while I am still alive." That's an exact quote. That's the way she talked. And by this, she meant that she wanted to buy land and build a second house for LaBrie. It was her way of saying it. And remember, we don't solicit. We never asked her. We didn't ask her. We prayed to be able to expand, but we did not ask her to do anything for us or anyone else. We all started praying for land on the street. Our neighbor Phil owned all the land that surrounded us, so Dick and Barry asked him several times if he would be willing to sell us a house lot. Phil didn't want to talk about it, so he just didn't respond. Then early one Sunday morning in May 12th, 1983, I woke up with a very strong sensation that God wanted me to go talk with Phil that day. I felt I should be totally frank about our struggles with overcrowdedness in the house and ask him to sell us land. So I rose early and prayed for a couple of hours before anyone else got up. I read and prayed through the book of Esther, feeling that I was going before someone intimidating who had the power to give or withhold my request. I admit, this may sound melodramatic, overdramatic, the context was entirely different, and unlike Esther approaching the king, I was not taking my life in my hands. Still, I felt I was pleading for the life and future of this work. Later in the morning, I went to the neighbor, while others at LaBrie prayed. I told him the work was going well enough that we had a problem of too little space. As a man who greatly valued his privacy, he responded, "Any fool could have told you that years ago." And then, without a word, he got up and left the room. I sat on the sofa wondering where he'd gone, what he was doing. A while later, Phil returned with a survey map. He sat down next to me, didn't say much, but he sat down and showed me the property lines on the map and said he would be in touch with us. So I came home. Later that week, he came by the house and took Barry, Dick, and Veronica to walk the property lines that surrounded the field opposite the big house over there. Then he offered to sell us the whole 15-acre field. He wasn't willing to divide it, to sell us less of it, but he was willing to have us pay for it over a couple of years. Everyone who knew Phil in town was amazed that he was willing to sell the field that many called his horse heaven. He had horses there, and once a year he held an annual fox hunt, the first Sunday of every November, when hounds and horses would all gather on that field. This land was clearly the most suitable for LaBrie, as it's right across the road from the front door of the big house. Dick and I then had the privilege of drawing up a floor plan for the new LaBrie house, including a large dining room for student meals and a multi-purpose apartment upstairs over the garage, which has been used for worker families, or rather single workers, and at times worker students' families. Sorry, not worker. Student families. In designing the floor plan, we were very intentional in designing it with long-term family survival in mind. And our generous donor was an amateur architect, and she drew up the elevation plans. Our friend Al McQuarrie, who had done the major renovations on this house, offered to build a new house. He did such a good job that during construction, the Southborough building inspector often came over to see the progress, particularly when he was feeling depressed about shoddy building practices. It gave him joy to see the quality of workmanship going into the 43 Lovers Lane house. The building process had its frustrations. Our donor wanted to be involved in every decision and gave money in a piecemeal way after long phone conversations with Dick at each new stage. He'd call to say, "It's time for the mason to build a chimney," or, "It's time for the plasterer, and he only has this window of time." But we respected her desire to invest herself and not only her money in this project that she cared so much about. And this lady had a lot of wisdom and practical sense about building houses. She could tell you the difference in the price of screws between Anderson Windows and one of the other window companies. She'd done her research. While the house was being built, Dick and I commuted 1.5 miles from the house that we rented. We also spent a few months in the big stone mansion on Main Street, which belonged to a distant aunt of Dick's. We lived there until we were able to move into the new LaBrie house. Our latest chapter. Dick and I were in 43 Lovers Lane from 1984 until April 2010. Toward the end of that time, it became clear that we would have to move off campus relatively soon to make space for a younger family. We had raised 3 sons in that house and clearly didn't need so much space anymore. Ben and Nikayla's twins, the girls who were here at the time, were in cribs and barely fit in a room that had been a closet for the master bedroom upstairs. The master bedroom, which is now the living dining room. There was no space for 2 toddler beds. And they were hoping to have another child. So Dick and I found a realtor and spent our days off looking at houses, a new experience for us since we always had our housing with our work. We found a house we love in the next town in Hopkinton, and were able to purchase it and move there in April 2010. The house is open plan, which gives us space to have students over for coffee and for some Sunday meals. So now, for the first time in our lives, aside from that year when 43 Lovers Lane was being built, we are commuters. We manage with one car while we lived here, but with different schedules, we had to buy a second car. We often feel like we became grown-ups and seniors at the same time, buying our first house in our 60s. We're very thankful to be able to continue our involvement in the branch that we started in 1979, while leaving more of the day-to-day running of the work to such a capable and gifted group of younger colleagues. And we're also hopeful about some new ideas that we have together prayed and brainstormed about. For example, our Friday night Saturday seminars, which we started a couple of terms ago and plan to continue. And our blog, which is something Dick and I, who are extremely low-tech, would never have been able to get started, but we have people doing that now. And we're thankful that our younger workers are getting increasing numbers of invitations to go out and speak in places outside LaBrie. So in conclusion, the story I've told about the South Borough LaBrie has emphasized the beginnings of the work and a couple of large structural changes, provision of a second house and our moving off campus. I've not had time to say much about the many wonderful individuals and families who've spent time with us, as Edith Schaefer does in her book. I've also told the story very much from Dick and my perspectives. We're the only workers who have been here from the beginning, but the work could never have happened without a team of wonderful, gifted, and dedicated colleagues who have worked with us over the years, and I would be remiss not to mention them. So Dick was able to come up with a list of workers covering the period from May 1979 through May 2016. It staggered us to realize how many people have played a part in the unfolding work of the South Borough LaBrie. I'm just going to read their names. This is not in perfect order. Some of you who've been around for a while will certainly know some of them. Barry and Veronica Segrin. Susan McNabb, our first single worker, and after she married, Susan and Bill Latimer. Peter and Rebecca Foster. David and Darby Zink. Greg and Mary Jane Grooms. You also will recognize some of their names from lectures that are here. Joe and Sue Morell, our most long-term workers who arrived in June 1995 and are still here. Steve and Brenda Stockford, Sarah Bucky, and Ryan Hamilton, who got married toward the end of their time here as single workers. Ingrid Lilly, Tommy Shaw, Doug LaFountain, Mark and Terry Ryan, Michaela Fiore, now married to Ben, who are both workers, Taylor Seacrest, Danny Burbeck, on the sofa here, Rebecca Klink, and Philip Johnson.
Brian
Redeen. I remember him. Why haven't he missed? Oh, I'm coming to the one. Oh yeah, I haven't mentioned you either. You know what? I remembered them, and Dick, they weren't on Dick's list. Isn't that funny? But I forgot to.
Claire Bosens and do you count Joan Holter?
He wasn't really a worker, though. No. But Brian Redeen, thank you. Brian Redeen.
One of our workers away.
Yes, right. He married Tommy Stroll. Thank you. Do you know, it's funny, because those are two that I jotted down before I got Dick's list, but then I forgot to put the list together. Sarah Barnes, Brian Redeen. If you think of anyone else, tell me. And our present workers, Joe and Sue Morell, Ben and Michaela Kies, Mary Frances Giles, and Sarah and Joshua Chestnut. And that's where I will end. So anything you want to raise? We go on, as those of you who've been here before, we go on with discussion for while I still have my voice. Yeah.
Somewhat of a random question. When you was in London, that was your home, and then Greta went to more of the country. What happened to the London branch?
The London branch. Yeah.
Was it closed when you moved here?
No, that's an interesting question. It was when we left there. Was it bought by the Larsons right after we left? Marty and Elliot Larson, who lived in South Borough for quite a long time, they had been in Afghanistan, a doctor and a teacher, They had actually been kicked out of Afghanistan, being suspected of being CIA agents, moved to London when we were there, became part of our church. Elliot was an elder there. They became very close friends. And when we left Ealing, it was decided there really wasn't anyone else to... it was decided not to keep that house as a branch of LaBrie. It was, however, church. Actually, the church had moved out to a rented building by that time. But the Larsons had just inherited some money from the death of his mother, and they ended up buying that house because they were still living in London. And they bought the house, were there for a while, and then ended up, they've moved here later, but they still owned it and really wanted it to be, made it into a kind of what they call in England a housing association with some apartments for people who needed places to stay, but also had some community time together. For a while, their son and wife lived there. They sold it, whatever happened. They sold it fairly recently. But the church has remained. It's a branch of the International Presbyterian Church, which is a denomination that was started in Switzerland with the Schaefers, but has, there are many congregations, many Korean congregations, some in Korea, but Korean congregations in England. And there is still a branch of the International Presbyterian Church, which is in another building. They were able to buy a house which had been a kind of a part of an embassy. No?
Church.
Oh, they bought the church. Yeah, I can picture it, but it was near. Anyway, they bought it.
Church is doing fine.
Church nearby, and they're doing very well. Church is, so, yeah, thanks for that question. Any other?
Question for you, Mary.
Yeah.
You and Dick, you made comment of that there's been no space to hold on to the way that things have been done and always been done, and I was actually thinking this morning about Jesus talking about new wineskins for new wine,
mm-hmm.
And one of the things that has been inspiring to me, mm-hmm. in entering this work is seeing and sensing that that excitement in you too, mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, what has sustained that vision for you? What has kept you flexible, expectant, for being open to new ways of, mm-hmm. of approaching things?
Mm-hmm.
It just strikes me as, that's not a given. Like, we have to work at that. Like, we all become entrenched in the way that we do things.
One of the things that Francis Schaeffer, that I heard him say frequently, was the Holy Spirit is never old-fashioned in the bad sense, but that there one needs to be... There are truths that are always true. Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And there are truths that will always be true. But the expression of the Christian faith and the leading of the Holy Spirit is never... Remember, is that, that's how we put it to me. The Holy Spirit is never old-fashioned in the bad sense, just holding on to things because my grandmother did it this way, or because the Schaefers did it this way, or something like that. And that, I've thought of that often. But also, Dick and I are very aware of areas that we are really weak in, like technology. And we live in an age of technology. And we have lots of discussions around here about the good things and the bad things about technology. And yet, we don't want to be just dinosaurs and say, it's funny because Schaeffer initially refusing to have anyone tape their discussions, and then actually seeing how the taping of that discussion was so helpful to people made him open to change. So, I don't know, Dick, do you want to say anything? We're very aware of, we've been really thankful for, we've always been thankful with all of the workers who've come here, through here, that we've worked with. When they've contributed new ideas, got us to think about hey, we don't have to do it this way. But, I mean, everything from very practical things, like I remember we used to have, everyone had a day off on Saturday. And one of the workers said, who had little kids and was serving lunch to students on Sunday with no help, just said, this is killing me. Can we have different days off? And, yeah, why not? You know, there's nothing sacrosanct about when we have a day off. And just being able to, very often, changes have come from just seeing the need or people here offering a suggestion and thinking, talking it over, thinking, yeah, there's no good reason why, you know, there's nothing set in stone about that, sure. And we've been really grateful for contributions that people who have strengths that we don't have or ideas that we don't have. I don't know. Dick, do you want to say anything?
I think oftentimes we've not felt that those are easy decisions as to what's intrinsically liberty and we need to stand on and what is negotiable and we need to move on. And sometimes it's been very, very hard. We wrestle with it all the time. But one thing I think that's hit me is that so many people come through here, arrive with great grievances from just the thought of, I'm in a church or I'm in a Christian group where no one can ever hear a new idea. Mm-hmm. And so we can't help but respond and learn a lot through the grievances that we have come to Liberty and the struggles that our students have. And those are certainly massive, you know, the people who have come through here who are just stuck in a situation that they desperately like to change. But you know, it's never been done this way. Yeah. It's always been done this way, and we can't do it any different. So I think we have sort of regular reminders of how stupid we can be if we allow ourselves to be.
That's exactly, you know, kind of the scenario I was thinking of, like how often a new idea or a question is perceived as a threat. You know, and so to cultivate a disarmament mm-hmm. in ourselves. Mm-hmm.
But that is a real a battle, because Liberty or any organization must have an identity that is solid, that is a core. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, it's anything anyone wants it to be. So I don't find that ever easy.
We have we've had lengthy discussions over the years on on different ideas, theological ideas, different ideas that have come up in different branches where workers have maybe taken a different view on any number of things, on denominations, on church order, on the Bible's teaching on women. All sorts of different issues, and we took a lot of time a number of years ago hashing those things through together, realizing again we working through what are the things which we really believe in a sense need to be creedal statements that all workers believe in and hold to, and where is there room for diverse views on things. We worked that through very carefully, and we put together two teams of two workers with the most different, divergent views on things to work through together a statement that they could both agree on and then present to all the other members, and then we talked through. And so we came up with a group of, with a bunch of Liberty statements on, this was when postmodernism was kind of in, and there were issues about knowledge and all sorts of different issues. I can't remember what they all are without looking back at the statements. But that was a really fruitful time, which both affirmed our what we all really were standing on, but affirmed where there was room. And that was something that Schaefer was very, so often think back to things he said, which were so wise, talking about the need for form and freedom, and to be sure that the form we have, the absolutes we stand for, are biblical absolutes and not things that we've added from our culture or from our church tradition, but which are negotiable, and be sure we really fight for allowing freedom on things where the scripture allows freedom, and not get, you know, sucked into all sorts of absolutes we've added to scripture. And in fact, the scripture warns clearly against both adding to it. If the warning is equally severe, don't add to my word and don't subtract from my word. Because when you add to it, it's just as much of a distortion as subtracting from it. So there's really, we've been really thankful for that, which goes back to the beginning. And very often we've realized that the Shapers had a lot of wisdom on things like this in terms of setting up a kind of framework, and we've gone back to that, the form and freedom idea, for example. Yeah.
I suppose that for students, it's difficult to live in community. Mm-hmm. But I suppose that for students, if they have like one term and then he don't like to leave or she, he can maybe, well, that's not for me, and he go away. Yeah. But in your case of workers, you live in community for years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So among you workers, how do you build trust and, I suppose, recover trust when it's damaged?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me say one thing that, again, has to do with sort of structurally, which is a help, which is a huge help, is we're a community, and it depends on how you define community. We're not a commune. We really believe in this distinction of family units and also of structuring a work so that the families and the single workers have their own space and have time to themselves. So that it's one of the reasons why, we learned very early on, it's very important, I feel it's really important to have three units in a branch to be able to do that, to be able to protect each other, to be able to close the door when you have a day off or when you're not serving a meal and have family time, have time on your own to be able to do the things that you want to do. And that's some protection, because you're not just all together in community all the time in a way which would get everybody frayed and everyone would burn out, very quickly. But we have, in the history of this work, have had some times of real difficulties with some disagreements that were strong enough that they were quite difficult, and where some people actually went and worked in different branches because we had a different vision of the work and how to do it. But we have tried to be honest and real with each other. And I mean, just thinking of a very biblical principle: don't let the sun go down on your anger. If you have a problem with somebody, that you talk with them about it. That you don't sleep on it. I have been corrected by workers in this branch for saying really thoughtless things, and I'm really glad they corrected me quickly and didn't let resentment build. And I think those are principles that are just biblical principles about how to communicate forgiveness, the need to forgive, the need to ask forgiveness, and being current with those things is really important. Do you want to say something?
I struggle a lot with this, and it's interesting to me that early 1970s, there were something like 10,000 intentional communities in the United States. Almost none of them lasted more than a year. 10,000, and just poof. And I could go into all sorts of things, but I think one really interesting thing to me is that the Bible gives us three basic institutions. There's the state, there's the family, and the church. There's something very wise in those three institutions being anchors for us. If a community trespasses and takes away the sovereignty, in a sense, or authority of any of those three, the community is going to be in trouble. If one head man of the community decides to discipline everybody else's children, for example, or demands, of course, sexual rights to anybody, right? Because this is one of the main
things.
Or Christian communities, very often, we collect everybody's money, all their money. And so they're left helpless if they want to leave. I mean, there are some really, I think, deeply foolish things that one can get into for not really respecting a family. Really has to be a family and stay a family and be strengthened as a family and be fed as a family by the community itself. But the family is not the church. There needs to be a church, another thing, with its theological authority and so on, and then the state is the state. So that's, it's amazing how many communities lose their grip on that, on respecting those three things. The other thing, much more practically, is that we, to be a worker even, one has to, as Marty said, be a student for a full term, and be a helper for at least a full term, if not two full terms. And that means, gosh,
get to know people.
You really get to know people. That's terribly hard for people a little bit older. If someone isn't married or is married with no kids, that's not so hard. But even then, it's not so easy because you've got a big, almost a year of your life you're checking out, and you don't know whether it's going to go anywhere or not. We say, we're not going to guarantee you anything, and you would guarantee us anything during that whole time. So no commitments in that whole time. That's very, very difficult. Terribly difficult for people with sort of the number of children who are older and need to have another career and get paid soon. But we can't figure out a better way to do it than to do it so we really get to know people well. I think we've stepped out of that a few times, and we've almost always
regretted it. Yeah. We sometimes have people who send us wonderful sounding resumes. I want to work at Labrie. Here's my resume. And, you know, some of them sound very high powered and have PhDs and all this stuff. And we say, well, the way people work in Labrie is they come as a student first, to come as a student, because there's no way of knowing. Sue, were you going to say something?
I just wanted to add something to your question, Ro, about the surviving community, and that is that to varying degrees, and Francis differ with this too, I think it's very important to have a life outside of Labrie.
Yes.
As workers, we all do have to be members of churches, and in some branches there's less choice, and you may all belong to one or two churches. At this branch, we all belong to different churches. Mm-hmm. And we really encourage each other, particularly encourage new workers, you have to find a life outside of Labrie. You need friends, you need a church, you need support elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Because it normalizes life too.
Yeah.
But it also gives you a great input back into life.
Right. That's right. Yeah, Danny.
Yeah, I think another reason that a lot of communities struggle is because they say people see community as being the end goal, that we're just going to live together and it's going to be great.
Right.
And I think one of the strengths of the Labrie community structure is that the students are temporary and the workers are there for the sake of the students. The workers don't all live here and just to be together, and if the students didn't come, they wouldn't be living here. Mm-hmm. In community like this. And I think it's that real outward focus.
Yeah.
In a sense, it's inward in that it's branch focused, but the purpose of the community is for the sake of those that are going away, that are coming and going.
That's true.
And it's not seen as an end unto itself, it's a context.
That's true.
It's a means or an environment that God has really used to help people. And I think
that's good.
That's really, and when it becomes only about just us and how much we like each other, like being together, and then that sort of self-referentialness can't hold up any weight and collapses.
And that's actually quite parallel to some ideas of marriage.
Yeah.
When marriage is seen as it's just about us, you know, how much we love each other and how much we like to be together. It's, marriage, it can be defined in an idolatrous way that can't bear the weight. And actually, marriage is meant to be serving as well, serving other people, open, a total unique commitment to each other and to your family, but an open home and reaching out and start seeing that you're basically your purpose, whether you're married or single, is serving God's kingdom. Yeah, Mary Grace.
I can just speak for sufferers. So I don't know how other groups would deal with this, but I think we kind of typically we do take very seriously for ourselves, but for one another, the families and individual needs. And so, just as an example, we're actually ending our summer term this summer a bit earlier than we typically do, so that the Kaizens and the Chestnut can do a family camp that they went to last summer and found very, very, very important and valuable for their family. And it was really important for them to be able to travel again. And so we, as a branch, made a decision you know, for their two families to be able to have that experience that they felt was a really important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember a couple years ago when I was just sort of stuck with some things as a single worker, Marty telling me, you can leave and go have dinner with your friend. Just because you don't have a child to go see their soccer game, you know, you're just because you don't have blood family here, your friends here are your family, and it's okay mm-hmm. for you to go out on a night you're not making dinner for students and go have dinner mm-hmm. with somebody or go have coffee for somebody because you need that to Sue's point to maintain life. And so, again, I can't speak to all branches. I don't, but I've got something here in software that we, I mean, obviously, we have to keep the work going, right? We can't all do it, but I think that we try to really give and take to kind of be aware of what feels critical for individual workers and individual worker units and to make those things happen when we can. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any other thoughts, questions, additions, subtractions? Thank you all. Thank you for coming. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you.